Hello, and welcome back to the slideshow. I'm Dakota Jackson. I'm a trombonist here in New Orleans, devoted to creating a appreciation of the trombone. And I got my co-host Ben back with me. I know you missed him while Jared was subbing in. What's up, Ben?
Hi, guys. I'm Ben Wiltz. I'm a bass trombone enthusiast and fishing guide. I just got back from Alaska. And I'm glad to be back on the show after spending my season up there.
Yeah. So life has been a little crazy. I just got a new puppy, so I haven't been sleeping. So I'm pretty sleep deprived. So I'm going to try and kill it this episode. And I've been playing quite a bit of trombone just with gigs and stuff. Not as much practice as I would like right now because of the puppy, like I said, but... doing a lot of community stuff, doing a lot of gigage stuff, a lot of Latin band stuff. But that's kind of what's been up with me. What's up with you, Ben?
Not much, man. I'm getting accustomed to life back in the lower 48 again. It was nice to have a good season, good summer up in Alaska working. You talked about doing some community work. I just got involved with a nearby community orchestra, so I'm excited to be playing some trombone in an ensemble. That's something I haven't really been able to do recently, so nice to get back on the horn. But yeah, that's pretty much what I got going on.
Yeah, man, I there's like a community orchestra here, but like I just can't be just with gigs and everything, I can't be doubling up. I do the trombone choir. Like I had to kind of felt like I had to choose one, and like I don't know, it's pretty easy to go trombone choir personally, just with what I'm all about and everything. But yeah, community orchestras are sick. I'm all about doing some community work, especially if you're like a pro trombonist or a teacher or something. I think like, you know, you got to be the people who are out there making it happen. You know, because it's hard for people who don't play for a living or something to find somewhere to play. You know, so you got to be on top of it. Normally, I would do some kind of goofy like beer plug or whatever, but I finally got around to making the Patreon. So the Patreon exists now. It's really cheap, starts off with $3, and the biggest thing is it's just gonna be super beneficial for us in terms of keeping this going. It's a lot of work, but more importantly than that, like, it does cost money to keep all this going, just to keep it pumped out to everybody on the podcast server, and then like I'm sitting on Zoom right now paying for that, so there's definitely like a little bit of cost that like a couple people joining up on the Patreon could help out with. And there's gonna be a lot of cool stuff on there. Me and Ben already made some videos on there. I've got some polls up on there. The whole spiel is on there if you want to go on there, but basically I'm going to do like a playlist for every episode. We're going to do deep dives. You'll get to actually see our faces if that's like a big deal for you.
Hold on, let's not scare them away just yet. Let's try to bring them back towards the Patreon.
I think that like if you listen to this and you're like, man, I'd be all about some like crazy even more deep dives or just like more random trombone stuff, it's definitely the place for you, because we did a little deep dive the other day and it went everywhere. We started off talking about trombones that were built in the 1400s and ended up talking about Charlie Vernon's suit. So I don't know, it's a hip. It's cool. Go check it out. It's on. It's on Patreon. You can just look up The Slideshow and it should pop up. Probably pop up. You just type in Slideshow, but for sure it'll pop up if you type in The Slideshow. And we'd really appreciate it. It'd be super cool. So, I don't know. I feel a little weird plugging it and asking for money and stuff, but like I said, it's not a lot. I also know that we've been a little sporadic with episodes for a number of reasons, but the Patreon will be different. It'll be going more consistently, like even if this isn't, which is another thing with the community we're building on Patreon, is trying to figure out what we're going to do with this going forward. Kind of like at the moment trying to decide if we're going to do monthly, bi-monthly, or like a season format, stuff like that. So like if you join the Patreon, I'd love to hear from you and kind of get your thoughts on that. But Ben, what you got going on with trombone in the news?
So I was looking for trombone in the news, and I know you and Jared did Trombone Champ, which has been all over the news. So it was kind of tough finding something in the news involving trombone. So I actually dug a little deeper from a story earlier this summer, since I've been gone, since the last episode I was on. And I found an article that is just a video of apparently a music teacher playing a trombone to scare a bear away from a school. There was a bear sitting on top of a dumpster. Person played a trombone, bear ran off. Pretty simple, but it was a trombone in the news article. And I'm sure if you Google those exact words, or just Google trombone bear, I'm sure you'll find this video to get a little laugh out of it. There's not much to it.
Yeah, if you get attacked by a bear, then you should obviously start playing your Remington exercises. And if the bear kills you, I'm not legally obligated. That wasn't legal advice. That was just a spitballing. Although in the video, man, he's not afraid of the drums, right? Like he's like more afraid of the trombone. Like it's proven
Yeah,
that
that was
bears hate the
actually interesting.
trombone.
Yeah, that was interesting. They were playing a snare. The bear didn't seem too comfortable with the snare, but when the trombone started playing in the background, it really did take off. I guess the bear was sitting outside of it was outside of a music room. They just had the window open and were trying to figure out what sounds it reacted to. It didn't like the trombone. That's for sure.
All right, man. Well, it's getting right into it. This week we're doing Glenn Miller, or this month, whatever. We're doing Glenn Miller, and I don't know, man. Like, this is kind of a cool topic because Glenn Miller, I mean, we'll talk about this, but he's not just like a famous trombonist. He's like a famous musician. Like, what is his scope of what he did is kind of interesting because he was like a pop star of the day. You know, I mean, this guy was he won the first ever gold record, actually. I don't even know if we were gonna talk about that in the pod. This is just kind of the crazy stuff that's associated with this guy. Like he's very like Americana pop music, like not just jazz or big band or whatever label of trombone. It's like he was like the mainstream music of the time. So, it's kind of an interesting topic to approach. But I'm gonna start off with like his early life. He was born in Iowa, Clarinda, I think is how you say it, March 1st, 1904. But he was like he moved around a little bit. He moved to Missouri, then Nebraska, and kind of ended up in Colorado. And he started off playing the mandolin, but switched to the trombone. And I don't really have a bunch of information on that, so I'm not sure when that date happened. But I do know that he played trombone in high school in Fort Morgan, Colorado. He played in the band. Also, there's like a ridiculous amount of information on this dude. It's crazy. Like, not many guys were talking about where they played in high school and stuff, but because he was famous, there's a bunch of stuff out there. I mean, there's literal movies about him. But the first group that he was kind of noted playing with was the Boyd Senator Orchestra from 1921 to 1923. And Boyd was like in his early 20s in Colorado when this happened. And basically, the most notable thing about Boyd now is that Glenn Miller was in his orchestra. And I couldn't really find a ton about Boyd Senator, but or Center. Sorry, I keep calling him Senator, but it's Center. Senters. I don't know why my brain wants to fill that in the Senator. Boyd Center. He's not really famous. Like, the most famous thing about him is that he employed Glenn Miller. but he was like had a jazz band in his early 20s, and Glenn Miller joined up. But Center was billed as Jazzologist Supreme. And I guess he played a lot of instruments, saxophone, trumpet, and other horns. But he also played clarinet, and that was what kind of like launched him. But Senator also had other famous people in his band, including Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey. If you don't know, Jimmy Dorsey is Tommy Dorsey's brother. If you don't know who Tommy Dorsey is, that's a little surprising since it's a trombone pod. But Tommy Dorsey is a super famous trombonist, and Jimmy Dorsey is his brother who played trumpet. I believe Jimmy is his younger brother. I'm 90% sure on that. But Center, like, I guess he like recorded some electric album, or he claimed he recorded the first electric album, so I'm not really sure what that means in terms of instrumentation or what. But later albums never really released due to everyone getting drunk. I guess he was kind of like I guess he was kind of a party animal. Mobile Blues that was never released in the US because he and the other musicians and the engineer got too drunk while they made it. And then Sinter ended up dying in 1982. So, man, that's actually kind of crazy to think about. I know this is kind of a weird offshoot, but I always think about, like, you know, we have, like, really precise images, like, of when people are born depending on, or when they lived depending on, like, their impact on us. And thinking about a guy who employed Glenn Miller, I don't think about that guy existing in the 1980s. But, like, you know, it's not too crazy.
I just love how apparently things don't change. They got too drunk to release the recording.
In 1923 is when Glenn Miller quit Boyd's Orchestra to go to college, and he went to the University of Colorado before he dropped out to return to music. I don't really know how long he was there. I don't think it was very long, but, what's up?
Colorado's website that he apparently had 3 semesters of the same music course that he received an incomplete grade for. And then dropped out.
that's good to know. He's like Mark he's like Mark Zuckerberg for trombone. It's like, if you want to be famous, don't graduate from Harvard, just drop out of Harvard. But he moved to LA, and he worked with Ben Pollux for a bit, and then he moved to New York City where he was a freelance trombonist. And while he was in New York City, he became the musical director for Tommy Dorsey's band, with Tommy's brother, Jimmy Dorsey. That was in 1934. He then formed an American orchestra for British bandleader Ray Noble, first recorded under his own name in 1935 at 31 years old. Miller struggled for a little while before establishing himself. But, like, his rise to fame started when he formed his own orchestra and then reconfigured it several times until he kind of got what he was looking for. But he got a gig at Glen Island Casino in New Rochelle, New York, in 1939, and that's what catapulted him to fame. His performances were broadcast on the radio, and that gave him a lot of public exposure, which I think is pretty crazy. I don't really think anyone now is playing at a casino and getting, like, public exposure from that at all. I don't know, it's weird that his stuff was being broadcast out to people while he was playing this casino gig. But his first big hit was, he wrote Wishing, We'll Make It So, I guess, in 1939. And he also wrote Moonlight Serenade, which really went up the charts. I'm familiar with Moonlight Serenade. I'm not familiar with Wishing. Maybe I should be. Maybe if I heard it, I would be. But Moonlight Serenade is pretty popular. But, like, during this period, he became one of the top dance bands, which was kind of the dominant music of the time. And his music charts, In the Mood, Tuxedo Junction, and Pennsylvania 6500 were all written in 1940. Pennsylvania 6500, I believe, is, like, some kind of radio call from the day. I guess, like, I'm not, maybe I'm, like, dating myself here, but, like, I don't really know how this worked, but I guess you, like, called into an operator, and then, like, to give them who you wanted to call, you would, like, put in, like, the area and all that, and I guess Pennsylvania 6500 is what that is, or 5000, I'm sorry. Is that how that works, Ben? Do you know?
I have no clue. we're about a year apart, Cody, so I don't think we're the people for this. So hopefully we'll get some feedback.
Yeah, I mean, I had a cell phone when I was a teenager, so it was way before me. The only reason I even know about that at all is because I played a lot of Glenn Miller music when I was in my undergrad in big band. But, yeah, I believe it's like some, we could probably look it up. There's also, like, maybe it's a train thing. Okay, here we go. Pennsylvania 65000 is the phone number of the Pennsylvania Hotel in New York City. Before area codes, the first two numbers were called the exchange code and were expressed by a word whose first two letters were used as the numbers. So, yeah, it's like some kind of weird phone number from before I was hip to phone number stuff. But in 1941, Miller made his first film, Sun Valley Serenade, with Sonia Henie. And the film featured another one of his signature songs, Chattanooga Choo Choo, another one I'm familiar with. The following year, he appeared in a movie, Orchestra Wives, 1942, which is Connie Ward is in seventh heaven when Glenn Morrison's band rolls into town. She is swept off her feet by trumpeter Bill Abbott, and after marrying him, she joins the band, tours, and learns about life as an orchestra wife, weathering the catty attacks of other band wives. I have not watched either of these, unfortunately. And I kind of think about this because, like, this is right around when he entered the military, which I'm going to let Ben talk about. But like, I kind of wonder, like, I mean, he was, like, kind of like Justin Timberlake's, like, gone from singing to, like, movies. Or I guess maybe Mark Wahlberg. I don't know, like, I don't know if it would have gotten that big. But I do think he was breaking into an acting career that kind of got cut short. And I wonder where that would have gone. Maybe he was just kind of like a band in the background, but I would be interested. I'm very interested in this movie, Orchestra Wives. This honestly sounds hilarious. I mean...
Well, for what it's worth, you know, hot take on Elvis here, but if you watch towards the end of Elvis's acting career, you know, probably about movie 28, 29, 30, he actually got pretty decent at acting because he was so experienced in it. So I imagine if Glenn Miller would have had the time to do that, he probably would have got quite a few movies in.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But yeah, 1942 is when he entered in the military, and I'm gonna let Ben take over with the military section.
Yeah, so Glenn Miller, he was 38 years old in 1942, and he really wanted to help join the war effort. The first person he approached with branch he approached was the Navy. He asked to get a commission from them, which is just entering in with some type of officer rank. And the Navy said they really couldn't use him or his talents. When he asked the Army, they were pretty enthusiastic about taking him in, and they gave him a formal commission as captain. And he entered that in November. He entered in October 7th, 1942. And by November, he was transferred from just the Army to the Army Air Forces, which would later become just the U.S. Air Force. He was head of the Army Air Force Training Command and the training station for director of bands. But then as he moved on, he became the director of bands, and he was able to recruit any civilian that wanted to play for him. So they hired them. He would just need to sign his letter of intent to hire them, and they were able to join his band. So he was able to assemble the band that he wanted, including a lot of people who played with him from before this time in the military. And then in 1944, this band that he's assembled, which had been making radio broadcasts in DC and playing, this band that Glenn Miller assembled, he decided he wanted to move them to England to help with the war effort. This mostly came after D-Day. He was inspired by the Allies' efforts in D-Day, and he actually specifically asked to be moved to England so he could help out with the effort more. While they were in England, this is where the band really made a name for itself. They performed 300 live performances, which they say it. Apparently, he reached out to 1.2 million people during that time, which is absolutely absurd. And they also had 500 radio broadcasts. This is within about a 6 months' time. Because this started in June 1944, and December 15th, 1944 is when Glenn Miller did actually disappear. And we can talk about that in a bit, but I find it impressive the amount of people he reached. If you look, Major General Doolittle, who led the Doolittle raids over in Japan, he actually remarked, he said, next to a letter from home, Captain Miller, your organization is the greatest morale builder in the European theater of operations. So he was a significant part of this. Like, they actually used the band. They were huge on building morale during World War II. I don't think there were some USO concerts and things like that, I believe, recently. This is that level. Glenn Miller was helped lead the effort to entertain the troops and keep remind Americans of home. Americans who were actually, I was reading one of the sources was talking about some of the strangest things to American citizens who had to stay in England was the BBC broadcasting. Apparently they did not like it at all. And so that's why they formed the AFN, or the American Forces Network, so they could have American radio in Britain.
Yeah, I find it like, and so World War II would have been like a draft war, right? Like, I mean, and I'm kind of curious about his comparison between being drafted versus volunteering for the war. Just like, I don't know. Like, I wonder if he drafted, like, volunteered, wondering if he was going to get drafted, and where that relationship fell.
Well, he actually was too old to be drafted. That was part of it. That's part of what made that volunteer that much more special. He actually sought out going to the military whenever he had no chance of ending up being drafted or pulled in.
Yeah, that is crazy. It's crazy to think about how people used to join the military back then, like famous people, you know, like people were still into his music and stuff when he was in the military and stuff. But I know this is kind of not a musical reference, but Ted Williams, for example, quit playing baseball for a little while to go join the military. So yeah, that doesn't really happen too often now. It's hard to imagine like Harry Connick Jr. being like, "Hey guys, I'm gonna join the military effort for a couple of years and coming back." But that was not that crazy uncommon back then. So what you have on the disappearance, Ben?
Okay, yeah. So Glenn Miller's disappearance. So this is an interesting deal. So what happens was this was December 15th, 1945. It was the day before, or 1944. It was the day before a concert. And normally, the way these concerts go, he was going to Paris. So normally his manager would have been on this flight and they would have flown across the English Channel to Paris. And they would have set up for the concert. And then the next day they were going to perform. Well, it was a very cold, at least from what I was reading. There was freezing conditions. There was a very strong fog. And just the weather was bad in general, low ceiling, things like that. Not great for flying. The plane that these guys were in was called a Norseman. It wasn't a traditional. Because of that, they are restricted by the cloud ceiling. They can only fly as high as the clouds will let them. So you have some bad weather. So the most accepted story of what happened is that Glenn Miller and the pilot, Bassett, they were flying in that Norseman across the English Channel. They believe at some point either fuel lines froze up or the pilot lost their bearings and they crashed into the water, never to be seen again. They say the way the plane was built, they said none of it would have been really left over. They said it would have disintegrated on impact. A lot of canvas. Not really an aluminum, not an aluminum framed plane like we see today. It was a very light aircraft made with a lot of canvas. They say that the passengers would have taken the brunt of it. They said the plane would have been pretty hard to find, if not impossible, especially in those weather conditions. But no one knows why they had never made it. And so there were a lot of theories about it. And so that has led to some pretty interesting stories. There's a lot of debunked theories as to what happened to them besides the official Air Force story. Probably the most outlandish would be one I saw where Dwight D. Eisenhower actually wanted to have Glenn Miller killed, so had him assassinated. Yeah, Miller's family is not a big fan of that one. They actually talked about that. Another one was a little bit more optimistic one, but the length of the war definitely shows that that's not what it was. But apparently the other one was that Glenn Miller was on a secret mission to negotiate a Nazi surrender, and they felt like sending Glenn Miller was the he would be the right negotiator for such a task, which I thought was interesting. And then I actually found a People's Magazine article on this other theory, which had for a bit people think has a little, some people still think has a little bit of a credence to it. And it's actually I think it's a theory of friendly fire. But what they say happened was a group of RAF planes were needing to jettison bombs, as in just get rid of bombs in order to make it back because of the bad weather. And they say that they let all of their bombs go into the English Channel, like they were supposed to, about a mile high. And one of the pilots that was on that mission actually believe, or on that flight, believes that one of their bombs hit Glenn Miller's plane out of some freak accident. And for some reason, people have really locked on to that one. That one's also mostly been disproven, but yeah, that's nobody knows why this guy has come out and said this, but there's also he claims that he saw the plane go down. He just didn't know what it was, which I think the whole story is a little weird, but People Magazine did give him some time, so I guess that's an interesting one. And then a piece of German propaganda showing that Glenn Miller never crashed at all, but actually died in a brothel of a heart attack. And in order to cover it up, they made up the plane crash story. That, like I said, that was Nazi propaganda. It was the Germans trying to just discredit ally idols and figureheads, I guess. But I find it interesting that this one guy has had so many theories about his disappearance. I mean, he apparently had a pretty big effect.
Yeah, I think that any time that there's a lot of theories, especially crazy outlandish ones surrounding your death, it speaks a lot to your fame. There's not a ton of crazy outlandish theories about not famous people. I mean, so yeah, I think that that's definitely nuts. The German brothel one's pretty funny. I mean.
Was reading, and after his disappearance, the Army Air Force's band, their dance band, they did go on to play for 6 more months after, and they finally disbanded in 1945, which I didn't know that. I was actually surprised. I kind of thought that the Air Force band was just one continuous band up until they became the Airmen of Note, but apparently that didn't happen until 1950. So
Yeah, it is
but.
interesting. I wonder, you were talking about how Glenn Miller was able to pick his own musicians. I wonder if those musicians were picked by him and then immediately in his band, or if they had to go through some kind of basic training situation.
No, they did not have to go through actual basic training. They did. That was discussed actually. That was the big move when he got to build his own band. That was a big thing actually, and basic training.
Yeah, that's crazy, because I know if you get in like the Airmen of Note now or whatever, Army Blues or the Commodores, is that the Navy has? If you get in one of these military bands, you do have to go through basic training. And then you pop out on the other end like a musician officer kind of situation, but yeah, that's, I mean, it kind of speaks to, I think that speaks to his fame, and I think it kind of speaks to the time and the number of things, but yeah, that is crazy, man. I mean, the Dwight D. Eisenhower theory and stuff, I mean, I actually bet that some of those, especially like the brothel thing and the Eisenhower and the weird friendly fire stuff, I bet all of that is somewhat insulting to the Miller family legacy, because on top of being super popular, I think he's also kind of immortalized as like an American icon. Like, he's a large piece of Americana just in terms of, not only was he a popular musician, but he was a popular musician in the military for America, so he's like ingrained in American culture.
Yeah, you know, those theories, the friendly fire one, it just seems a little bit attention seeking coming from that guy years later. Like, he just made, like, he connected the dots and was like, oh, that random plane we hit is Glenn Miller. And I saw some things where these guys talked about, like, well, if he was a mile high and how low the ceiling was, like, there's no way that he would have ever seen the plane to begin with. And especially from how far the bombs would have had to drop. Like, so it was it being that outlandish, it just kind of makes it seem like the guy was just wanting to make Glenn Miller's death about him. And so, I don't know. I don't think there's as much mystery there. I think it was a situation of bad weather. Even supposedly Glenn Miller commented that day, which is pretty terrible. He said, "Where's the parachutes?"
Oh, man. Yeah, my dad is actually a crew chief on a C-130 in the Air Force, so he knows a lot about aviation and stuff. I don't. None of that has been passed to me. But I bet he would be interested in that. He's told me a lot of stories about planes going down and stuff. It's kind of weird. I always end up talking to him about that, like, after I fly. Man, there's a lot of crazy trombone deaths. I think this ranks towards the top. Not the top at all. But definitely towards the top. Even if it is just death at sea in an airplane. I mean, especially in the middle of military service. That's nuts.
He had an incredibly short military career to be as famous for doing so much for the military as he did. Like I said, the concerts that he is most famous for putting on, those 300 live performances that happened within just that short amount of time. I mean, yeah, he reached out 1.2 million people during that. Like, he got a lot done in a very short amount of time that I don't think I was aware of before this. I think I just assumed it was more spread out across the whole war, not just right near the end.
Yeah, I kind of have a similar thought, just that, like, I kind of always assumed the Glenn Miller Band was a military band in general. And then kind of, like, when we were doing these research, just, like, the casino stuff that when he got famous at Glen Island, I didn't realize, like, Moonlight Serenade, In the Mood, Pennsylvania 65,000, those are some of his most famous songs. I kind of all thought that those were, like, military songs, which I'm sure he'd continue playing them when he was in the military, but yeah, it's certainly he definitely was getting big before he got in the military, which, you know, adds to, I think, the mystique and the lore. And I think it's like about how he's branded now too. We'll kind of talk about his music later, but like, there's a ton of, when you buy Glenn Miller stuff, it's not like it's not like Coltrane, where you have, like, Blue Train and Coltrane Sound and Lush Life and all these things. It's like, there's a lot of compilations, I feel like. I feel like that's the most frequent way you see his music, especially in vinyl format. I see a ton of compilations of stuff, and those all seem to have, like, a lot of, like, American patriotism to them. Just, like, flags and stuff, and he's in military uniform and stuff, and so I kind of always assumed that was kind of his main shtick. But he definitely was famous before that, you know? I mean, he was definitely well on his way to becoming famous independent of the military, and kind of, like, as we talked about, as a decision, made that part of his legacy.
I think that's how he got in with the Army. I think that was his biggest appeal. So the way the Army was doing their recruiting for the musicians, like, that way was, they needed people with a very wide reach to begin with. And I think he might not have got that commission as captain if he wasn't as famous as he was. At least I wouldn't think so. Because they did make it seem like the Navy couldn't use a 38-year-old time. So if the Navy turned him down, like if it wasn't for the Army's program that they were putting together to get these musicians. Because I know Irving Berlin was one of the musicians they got too, by the way, which I know Irving led a lot of the classical music side of things.
Yeah, that is crazy. I can't even really picture. I mean, I'm kind of out of the loop. I don't know who's a famous musician right now, but just imagine if, like, I don't even know. Like, Jennifer Lopez was like, hey, I'm joining the military, and, like, I don't know. It's just wild to think about now, but, you know. Like I said, probably not that crazy back at the time with just, you know, famous people in general joining the military. But, yeah, man, I think we're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back with some gear and stuff. I know you guys love some gear, so be right back. All right, welcome back to the slideshow. All right, like I said, I was gonna break into some gear here. I know you guys love that gear, and with Glenn Miller, it's really apparent all of his stuff because he was so famous. There's really good record of what he was using. So he played a New York Bach 6 Model 7. I guess the 7 is like in Roman numerals. I'm not like a big Bach guy. Nothing. I don't have anything against Bachs. I kind of enjoy them, but I don't own it or anything. But it has his name stamped on it. And we actually have at least one of them. But the serial number is covered by a metal patch, which was probably used for a repair hole that formed over time. Which I don't know that really impacts anybody. I just know like. Some people, maybe not so much in the trombone world, but in the saxophone world, I know that some people get crazy and they're trying to like see how close they can get to like John Coltrane's horn and stuff with the Summers and stuff. So that might be kind of hard, but you can't figure out exactly what horn he played. After his death, his horn was played by a band member, Jimmy Preti. And then he donated it to the Glenn Miller Birthplace Society, which is where it's at now. There's a museum there in Clarinda where he was born. I found some conflicting reports that it might be in Dayton and not Clarinda, like it was moved around. But like I know some people have played it, like who are in the current Glenn Miller Orchestra and stuff, so that's kind of up for debate. But it's a 485 bore with a 7-inch bell and it's yellow brass, which is really tiny. The 7 was just in reference to the variety of options. Apparently in the 40s, if you wanted to play in his band, you had to play one of these horns because he wanted everyone to blend, which apparently there was a lot of this going around. We'll get into this in a minute. I actually hate that. I think that some people lean into some kind of stuff like that, but I don't know, man. If I was getting in someone's band and they were like, hey, make sure you're playing a Bach 6 Model 7, like... I don't know. That's whack. Like I'm not a fan of that.
So, didn't you have to do that in college at one point?
Yeah, I guess when I was an undergrad, we were sponsored by Jupiter. Although I wasn't really forced to play at Jupiter. I don't know. That was kind of a weird situation. It was definitely on the table like that. I was not forced to do it, but I guess close. But yeah, this horn's really small. You can tell in most pictures if you see it because it's got like a small counterweight and it's got a lighter counterweight and a really small bell. And I think when they made the Glenn Miller story in 1954, the actor who's playing Glenn is actually playing a Bach 6 as well. Which is nice. This is like a personal pet peeve, but I really hate whenever I see see movies about musicians and they're playing shit that's like not at all the instrument. I remember particularly one that comes to mind is like Don Cheadle did a movie about Miles Davis, which they were allowed to take a lot of liberties with because I don't want to spoil the movie for everybody, but like the movie's not real because it's like supposed to be like Miles Davis telling a story with his playing. I don't know. It's weird. But anyways, at one point in that movie, like John Coltrane is upstairs and he's playing like a brushed P. Marriott. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, I mean, we know, like I just said, he played a Mark VI Selmer. Like everyone knows what John Coltrane played. So that irritates me. I don't know if it's just because it was in the 50s or if it was Glenn's popularity, but I do think it's cool that they got his horn. And even more than that now, like you'll see movies with people playing trombones and stuff and they're like the bells upside down and stuff. Like they don't even know how to play it. So yeah, it could have been much worse. Like not to go off on a little rant about trombones and instruments and movies, but if you watch the movie Mo' Better Blues, that's a Spike Lee movie. It's got Denzel Washington, I think, took trumpet lessons for that movie. So if you watch him play, like, his fingers are right, and his lips look like he's playing, because he is playing. Now, he doesn't play like Terrence Blanchard, who's actually playing the trumpet, but, like, he does look like he's playing. But, like, you know, Branford Marcellus plays the saxophone part for the soundtrack of that movie, and Wesley Snipes just put zero effort into learning anything about the sax. And I never really watched his fingers, not that I play sax well enough to know what would be going on, but his embouchure looks all kinds of jacked. So, yeah, I don't know. Whenever you watch a movie, I mean, watch Whiplash, for example, like, weird stuff going on. I hate that. So, accuracy of instruments a big deal for me. But there, I found a little brochure from the 1940s that's got, Glenn Miller playing a Bach, talking about how all of his band members use a Bach. And it says he was on a Bach mouthpiece, but I don't think that's primarily true. And I have this weird little tidbit here, because Trombone Chat said that he was on an Al Almont mouthpiece, which Tommy Dorsey used to make everyone in his band use an Al Almont mouthpiece. I guess you can just call them Almont mouthpieces. And I found this out from like a former member who didn't like using them. And I've definitely seen, I was just talking a bit about this before this pod started, like, there's pictures of him using this mouthpiece, and it definitely looks like an Almont. And you can look up pictures of it, and there's a little bit of information about it, but yeah, there's definitely one out there that's got his name on it. But yeah, Almonts are, like, in the rare of mouthpieces. I'm not personally one to go hunt down old mouthpieces that are hard to find. I kind of think that, like, modern machinery and stuff, like, mouthpieces are probably trending upwards. I don't know. I say that. I don't really say that with a lot of knowledge or anything, but Almonts are definitely a difficult one to find. And I found a little Brass Arc thing talking about Almont mouthpieces because they were trying to make a replica, which is very Brass Arc-y. But I got a little write-up on Almont. It says, he was always a mystery to me. For those that don't know, Mr. Almont was a trombonist and mouthpiece maker and is famous for making mouthpieces for the Tommy Dorsey trombone section. His pieces are very rare, and they were all handmade, and you had to be in the know to get one. What sets these pieces apart was that they were made from solid sterling silver. Yes, solid silver. Now I've seen a lot of instruments and gear over the years, but I have yet to see an Almont in person. It is something I'd love to experience. If anyone out there has one willing to sell me, let's chat. But I've been bugging John and Brett Reeves to make one, make me a sterling trombone mouthpiece for years, to no avail. Material cost along is really expensive, and finding bar stock in the correct size is nearly impossible. So I guess they are a pain to find because of the material as well. But yeah, for sure played a Bach 6, and like I said, probably played this Almont. I don't know if he switched to a Bach mouthpiece at some point. That would make sense with, like, endorsements and stuff of the day. But he may have stuck with this Almont as well. And I also found kind of a weird video where this guy was claiming that he had Glenn Miller's first trombone from when he was 12 years old. And it was a Frank Holton Revelation Wonder. I don't know, I put, like, I was a little skeptical about it, because it's just, the video is, like, there's nothing really to prove that it was his horn. Not that it really even matters. I mean, like he's a Bach six guy. That's like, that's what's important. That's what he played when he was a professional. But it would be kind of fun to know that his first horn was a Holton or whatever. I think we found out, we knew what George Roberts' first trombone was, didn't we? I think we dug that up.
I don't remember if I got to see what the actual trombone looked like.
Yeah, but we knew the brand and stuff, right? Like, because he talked about it in an interview, I believe.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
I believe it was. Was it not a 6H?
I honestly don't remember. It's really asking me to dig through the archives to remember what his first trombone was.
I pulled that out of nowhere.
Man. So
probably not.
Like I said, none of that even matters, man. It's like the box six is what matters. And I would do, if you're looking for weird gear, I would dig into this Allmont thing because it's pretty interesting. I guess side note, even worse than making all of your musicians use a box six trombone is making them all use the same mouthpiece. Like, that's absolutely brutal. Like, human mouths are just not even the same. I mean, although, if Allmont was hand-making them, maybe he made them slightly different for people, but maybe not. What's up?
I was just saying I was looking more into these Allmont mouthpieces. That is insane. Apparently, today's measurements, we'd be looking at about $150 of melt value on a silver mouthpiece.
Yeah, that is crazy. I mean, I don't know, man. I mean, I think it's interesting that there's more, like, trombonists who have, like, ventured into making mouthpieces than, like, trombones. I mean, it makes sense, because trombone is a lot more going on than a small mouthpiece, but definitely trombonists have made mouthpieces before. I know, like, Doug Purviance is a big one, if you're hip to that. Like, Doug Purviance made a mouthpiece for somebody and they used it. Dennis Wick or somebody? I don't know. Don't quote me on that. Doug Purviance made mouthpieces that were kind of famous that, like, people would use, and you can't really get those anymore. Although, I think Bob Reeves is making, like, a replica of one now. But, yeah. That's kind of what I got for his gear. I mean, it's nice to get a precise thing, because I know with like the last episode we did with Palmieri, like all of those guys, it was really hard to narrow down their gear. I certainly wasn't getting anyone's mouthpiece. All right, kind of moving on to his legacy. I first wanted to talk about, there is a Glenn Miller Orchestra now. I am kind of like hyper familiar with it because when I was an undergrad, like we had a director who was in Glenn Miller Orchestra, at least for certain tours or whatever. It looks like they go on tour like every 2 months or so, so I'm sure he just went out occasionally or whatever. And they'll just hit little loops. It's actually crazy, like, I'm from a pretty small town called Harrison, Arkansas. I remember at one point when I was home, they played at a theater there, so they're definitely hitting some smaller venues as well. But they just play his songbook. They have recorded some albums. They all dress, like, in red. I don't really know what the significance of that is, to be honest. I don't know if that was something Glenn Miller did, if that was something that they started later on. But they all have, like, kind of, like, a little red suit thing that they wear. And they just play Glenn Miller songbook tunes. So, like, the stuff we were listing before. Which I was going to talk about, like, his music in general. I thought I might do, like, a deep dive on the albums and stuff. But, like, I don't really think that a lot of his music was album-based. It was more, and I guess this is kind of how a lot of pop stars are now. I don't know. I guess it depends who it is. But, like, it was more single-based. So, like, he would write a big hit, and then it would get popular, and it wasn't necessarily on an album. Which makes sense with, like, him playing in the casino, and then later in the military and stuff. But, like, if you go to Spotify, his top 10 are In the Mood, which a lot of people are familiar with. 75 million views on Spotify, by the way. Moonlight Serenade, Pennsylvania 65,000, String of Pearls, Chattanooga Choo Choo, In a Sentimental Mood, but he didn't write that. When You Wish Upon a Star, Tuxedo Junction, Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, American Patrol. But a lot of these are like big single things. And like I maybe I'm more familiar with other people because I played them. I actually feel like it's kind of interesting that when I was a freshman in college, I went to China, and because, like I said, we had that director who was in Glenmiller Orchestra, we played a lot of those tunes, and I played, like, In the Mood and Pennsylvania 65,000 in China, and I've always kind of thought, like, that was, like, the most American thing we could have played, like, because of, like, his legacy with the military and everything, and, like, kinda, that's literally what he did, was, like, take an American band overseas and, like, rally troops and stuff. It's, like, I feel like playing that music abroad is like some kind of weird American anthem in some way, you know?
And the Glenmiller Orchestra, I know you talked about, the Glenmiller Orchestra being his legacy band, but I think it's also worth noting that after his band disbanded in 1945, they came back in 1950. The Air Force created the tribute band, Glenmiller, the Airman of Note, but unlike Glenmiller Orchestra, which just plays Glenmiller's songs. But no, the Airman of Note, they put out plenty of music. They put on concerts, clinics. Just in general, they carry out more of the mission that Glenmiller had, not necessarily always playing his music, though.
Yeah, and I guess for people who don't know, to like distinguish, like, the Glenmiller Orchestra, that the legacy group that goes around now, is not a military group. They're like a little band that goes and plays tours or whatever. But like Airman of Note is obviously like the Air Force's top jazz band. We actually also, when we were at UAM, studied with a Airman of Note member as well. So I guess we got both ends of that.
Yeah, a lot of Glenmiller.
Yeah, I guess if you're interested in that, I will say that, like Ben said, it's like all public domain, so it's so you can just go check it out. Because I mean, it's federally tax dollars are paying for the band, yeah. So it's like federal. It's fairly funded, so you can just go look it up. They do have some pretty cool stuff. Sometimes they play like one that sticks out to me is. I can't think of the name of the album. It's like Out There or something. It's like a little, it's like a space view of the moon or something. But there's like an arrangement of Mr. PC, which is a John Coltrane tune. PC is Paul Chambers. But it's a super easy little tune. You know, but they like, the Airman of Note arrangement of it is just like insanely hard. I actually played it once because one of our directors had it, but it's like it's just absolutely nuts. So I don't know, there's some good stuff. And then we might actually talk about some Airman of Note people in here, particularly Dave Steinmeier jumps to mind as like a really significant lead player. Actually, you know what, since this is a trombone pod, I don't know why I'm plugging anything else. Go check out Bon Voyage, or Bone Voyage. It's just like the trombone section back when Dave Steinmeier was the section leader and stuff. It's really good. So they've got like Will You Need It and a couple other cool tunes on there, but it's just like a trombone album. So yeah, go check that out.
Dave Steinmeier.
Yeah, he's like a crazy achieved lead player.
Just hit your teeth with a brick.
Yeah. Yeah, that's some Dave Steinmeier lore. So yeah, I think just like one of the things I wanted to talk about was like Glenn Miller's legacy and what he represents and stuff. And it's weird, you know, we do a lot of episodes on here about trombonists that like I super dig their playing and all this kind of stuff. And not that like I don't dig Glenmiller's playing, but it, like what he's famous for is being a band leader and a composer and being like super famous. Like, I mean, it's weird to think, but like trombone is crazy, like, not always, like, in the public eye, but at that point, it was, like, the biggest thing out there, and, I actually heard this, during this Conrad Herwig interview. He was asked about kind of, like, his fame and, like, the trombone's role in public and stuff, and one of the things he brought up was, like, you know, it could always bounce back and be, like, the mainstream music again, because things like Skip a Generation, like, it, in all reality, it wasn't that long ago that, like, the trombone was the most popular instrument, like, in the country in terms of musicians, with Tommy Dorsey and Glenn Miller, and it's, like, I don't know, it's hard to even fathom that right now, but, like, at the time, Glenn Miller was, like, the most popular musician in the country. I mean, yeah, just, like, super, super famous, and I think that, like, that's kind of his legacy, is, like, being known as this big Americana guy and being known as, like, one of the bigger stars of the day.
Yeah, man, you know, when we did trombone and pop culture, I don't remember if we really spent time on Glenn Miller, but I think he was the ultimate pop star on the trombone anyways. I don't think we've really seen anything like him since.
All right, our album recommendation for this episode is Conrad Herwig's latest album, The Latin Side of Mingus. If you're not familiar, he's been doing a whole Latin series. Go check out the backlog on that. Wayne Shorter, Herbie Hancock. But the newest one, Latin Side of Mingus, has special guests, Ruben Blades, really famous percussionist, and Randy Brecker. But it also has Alex Sipian on it. Sipian, I think that's how you say he's Russian. He's a trumpet player. Craig Handy, Bill O'Connell, Lucas Curtis, Robbie Amin, and Camillo Molina, and obviously Conrad is playing trombone, and it is super slamming. I'm not even gonna lie, me and Ben were just talking about what album we were gonna do this week, and my love of Conrad is what pushed this to be the album. It's super
shocked.
Killing.
I'm shocked by this by this episode's album, Rick. I'll tell you that.
It's a banger, dude. It's good. You should go listen to it. Go download it. Go give my man Conrad some love. You'll be blown away. It's like everything else he plays, it sounds fucking insane. So. Oh, man. Well, I think that's going to do it for us. I'm glad that this one's not going to be super long. Like I said, I want to plug it again, especially if you made it all the way through the episode. Go check out the Patreon. I think there's going to be some cool stuff in there. And I don't know, I think it'd be super cool to kind of build a community, get, like, a Discord going, just get talking. Like, I'd like to engage with you guys. And also, like I said, like, the small amount of money, you know, buy me a coffee. It'll super help out with everything. This is a lot of work in post, like, you know, getting it all set up and everything, cutting out all Ben stuttering, you know, takes hours. You got anything you want to throw in there, Ben?
Yeah, man, I was just going to say, you know, we would really appreciate the Patreon deal because, like Cody was saying, you know, we come here, we record it, and then usually about a week or two later, it's released. There's a bunch of magic that happens in between. I don't know that side of it, but Cody claims it's pretty tough.
Yeah, it definitely is a lot of work getting it pumped out. So, as always, guys, thank you for listening, and happy shedding. Catch you on the next one.